This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting once again this week from the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned later this hour for a conversation on how storytellers have remade and revisited the Kennedy assassination again and again over the past 50 years. Longtime film critic and KERA culture producer Jerome Weeks will be with us. And your recollections and retellings of those events have been our companion all this week as well.
My name is Kathleen Jones, and I'm calling from Palmer, Alaska, and I lived in Anchorage, Alaska, when I was in 1963, and I was 10 years old. I was in my fifth grade classroom, and we were having a spelling test, and I remember they announced on the intercom that John F. Kennedy had been shot, and I remember still my tears going down onto my spelling test, but I remember exactly where I was.
Keep that conversation going at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org to see what others have shared. We're going to begin this hour, though, with some political damage control.
I hear you loud and clear. I said that I would do everything we can to fix this problem, and today I'm offering an idea that will help do it.
President Obama announcing yesterday now that he will allow insurance companies to reinstate plans that were canceled or to maintain existing plans that would otherwise have been canceled by January 1st under the Affordable Care Act. These plans can now remain in force for a year.
This fix won't solve every problem for every person, but it's going to help a lot of people.
It might help. It might also hurt the financing for the Affordable Care Act altogether, a complicated set of fiscal and consumer issues. And to discuss them, we're joined by Julie Appleby. She's a reporter for Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Let me ask you right off the bat, the premise of this political problem for President Obama is that people love their current health care plans and that they should be allowed to keep them, even if they're substandard under the Affordable Care Act in some way. I'm wondering, generally speaking, do consumers really know enough about their health plans generally to intelligently answer the question, I love my health plan, I don't love my health plan? What do you think?
You know, it really varies. I've done a lot of reporting on this over the last couple of years, and some people really do understand. They pick a policy that has a very high deductible, for example, and they have the money in the bank to cover that deductible, so they're not worried about it. Other folks may not understand that the policy they've purchased perhaps doesn't cover something like hospitalization. I was looking at some plans in Florida that don't cover hospitalization, and they only pay $50 toward the cost of a doctor visit. So some of those folks may not realize how vulnerable those types of policies might leave them. So it's a mixed bag, I think, with consumers.
I want to talk for a moment about the possibility that maintaining certain so-called substandard policies for is going to affect the financing of the Affordable Care Act. But what do you think is going to happen over the next year? Are people going to become more informed about their policies and be inclined to, at the end of the year, change them and become part of the ACA? Or are they going to cling to them and that we're going to be revisiting this problem in exactly a year?
Look, this is a really mixed bag as well right now, because we're not even sure how many insurers or state regulators are even going to allow these policies to be extended. So you've got the president making this announcement, but it's optional. Insurers and state regulators can decide if they want to move forward with it or not. It's complicated. We've got some states that say that they want to do it, like Florida and Kentucky and California have come out and said the regulators there want to do it. But we've got some states that are opposed, Washington, Arkansas, and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So consumers aside, we don't even know how many of these plans will actually be extended.
You know, part of the political, storm that the president is responding to is a sense that the Affordable Care Act is disruptive, that it actually reduces people's sense of security about their health care rather than increasing it. Do you think this fix increases the security for American consumers or increases the insecurity and uncertainty for American consumers?
Look, what he's trying to do here is it's a reaction to the consumer complaints. These folks who are losing their policies, who are upset that they do need to change to new plans. And he's also reacting to angst from the Democrats. Some of them are up for re-election, and they're very worried about how this is going to play out. There's the politics of it, and then there's the policy. So the policy side of this was that some people were buying plans that left them very vulnerable to very high costs. That was what the ACA tried to fix in some ways by mandating these certain level of benefits and a certain amount of out-of-pocket costs. They had to be capped at the end of the year. But some folks are still going to continue to choose those that may leave them vulnerable. But the concern is they don't want this to continue on. So we'll see what happens by the end of the year, if they're going to allow these policies to continue or not. But that is the concern. How many people will stick with policies that may leave them vulnerable to these kinds of costs?
Now, in terms of costs, if insurance companies continue to carry these policies and, you know, the maintenance of the so-called substandard policies under the Affordable Care Act, is that going to be a net cost to the federal government, to the insurance companies that are carrying these, that'll be passed along to consumers? How is this increased burden going to be reflected in the economy or show up in federal receipts?
Not sure it'll affect federal receipts. I think what they're really concerned about is that if too many people keep these policies, they won't be buying policies through these new marketplaces that were set up. And they really are depending on a lot of folks signing up in these marketplaces to spread the risks. They want younger people, healthier people, et cetera, to sign up through these new marketplaces to help offset the cost of older and sicker people. So if a lot of younger or healthier people, and remember, people who have these individual policies right now were generally healthier because they had to go through what's called medical underwriting. So they're generally healthier. If they keep these policies, they're not going to be in the exchanges. And over time, that could drive up costs through these new marketplaces, which could be a big problem for this ultimate success or failure of the federal health law.
What about the most vulnerable people, the people who aren't in the healthy pool of individuals that you've just described there? How does this presidential fix affect them?
Well, remember, one of the big changes in the Affordable Care Act is it says that insurers can no longer reject people with medical conditions or people or charge them more. So that's one big change. So this means for them that they can still shop around in the different marketplaces. If they get one of these cancellation notices, they can indeed go buy another policy and they can't be rejected because of that. That's one of the biggest changes in this health law.
Finally, what's your sort of gut feeling here? Should the president have hung tough and just stayed with the policy and encouraged people to actually get into the marketplaces and just told them you're going to get the information that you need? Saying goodbye to these policies is not as big of a problem as my political opponents are making it. Or do you think he had to do this?
I think he was really reacting a lot to A, the consumer complaints, but B, the real concern that the Democrats, some of them may decide to abandon some of this and go and vote. There's a House vote today that would allow people to extend these policies and buy new ones that fall short of the Federal Health Care Laws Act and continue them for quite some time. And they're very concerned that a bill like that would gain traction and it might pass, and that could undermine these new marketplaces over time.
All right. So a bipartisan criticism of the ACA means that the whole policy is getting away from the White House. So he had to respond. That's the conclusion of Julie Appleby. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Julie Appleby is a reporter for Kaiser Health News. So perhaps the biggest story on planet Earth in sheer numbers today may be China's decision to alter its longstanding family planning policy on childbearing. The famous one-child policy will be relaxed. Couples where one parent is an only child will now be permitted to have two children. This has cultural significance and political significance in China, a nation that has been radically changed by decades of the One China policy. Joining us now from London is Xiaorong Chen, managing editor at Foremost Four Media Limited. Xiaorong Chen, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
So can you gauge the cultural significance and political significance of this change in the One Child policy in China?
The one-child policy in China has been going on for many, many years. It's more than 20 years now in China. And the Chinese officials say because of this policy, China managed to reduce population growth by more than 400 million people. That's a huge number. As a result, what is happening now in China is an aging society. There are not enough people to work in order to produce stuff, and then in order to support their parents and their parents' parents, grandparents. So it's a kind of reverse pyramid in the society. Politically, the one-child policy was not that popular with the Chinese population, and many families try to have a second child anyway, or then they will get fined or beaten up in many cases. And some people are saying their human rights haven't been observed.
So the politics relate to supporting the economy and also trying to increase a sense of family within China. Do you think, demographically speaking, that this policy can in any concrete way address the issue of gender disparity, the way in which the one-child policy has really disrupted the mix of men and women of marriageable age in China, which is also a big issue?
You hit the nail on the head. Because of the one-child policy, what tend to happen, the Chinese traditionally wanted to have a son to carry on the family tree, as it were. So many people wanted to have a male offspring, and therefore we have seen problems of the female girls being dumped in some cases, and of course the sort of ultrasound scan to see the gender of the unborn baby before they try to do something about it. Now, with this change of the family planning policy, you would have thought that could be changed. But I'm not that optimistic, simply because nowadays, raising a child in China is very expensive, if not more expensive than, say, in the United States or in the United Kingdom.
So a small change in a very, very important family planning policy in China with huge economic and cultural implications, and it may have come too late to have the kinds of impact it's going to need to have. Xirong Chen, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Xirong Chen's managing editor at Foremost 4 Media Limited and former China editor at BBC Global News. We're listening to echoes of some tragic American history all this hour.
Margaret Federholm from Yonkers, New York. When Kennedy was shot, I was an 8-year-old girl, and we were all in our classroom, and suddenly the door boomed open, and the reverend said, "The president has been shot," and we froze, and we just didn't know what to do. And he said, "We must pray," and all of us made a formation, and we prayed so hard.
Thanks to Margaret there in Yonkers. From Kaja Boyd in Brooklyn, one of our friends and listeners. I was 11 then in Rabat, Morocco. Everyone cried, including my mother, who was a tough cookie, so I cried as well. I did not understand beyond the fact that some person was shot dead. My tough mom pointed to our staples bearing USAID stamps, flour, oil, and that's that. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Your recollections of the Kennedy assassination 50 years ago. We're live in Dallas. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Another big story out of Asia. All week long, we've been reminded of the special history and relationship between the United States and the Philippines, as the people in the devastated city of Tacloban, recovering from Typhoon Haiyan, look to the United States for assistance. We can also think back to the tumultuous political changes in the Philippines back in the 1980s.
Like Abraham Lincoln, I understand that force may be necessary before mercy. Like Lincoln, I don't relish it. Yet I will do whatever it takes to defend the integrity and freedom of my country.
Invoking Lincoln before a joint session of Congress, Cory Aquino in the 80s, the first president of the Philippines after the revolution that swept dictator Ferdinand Marcos from power. Former U.S. ambassador to the Philippines, Stephen Bosworth, witnessed that revolution firsthand as ambassador from 1984 to 1987. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
You know, I'm wondering how you think the famous People Power Revolution of the 1980s and this relationship between the Philippines and the U.S. prepares the country or even impedes it facing this long recovery after the typhoon.
Well, I think it's an asset in several ways, but most importantly, probably it's a asset because the Philippines has now a broadly based democratic system. It's not the most efficient system in the world, but it is a broad-based democratic system. And I think they're going to need that kind of popular support and popular participation in order to maintain some momentum going through what is, as you point out, going to be a very difficult recovery from this natural disaster.
Do you think the limited experience with democracy, and it's been a successful one in the Philippines with the problems, as you note, engages people in the recovery effort together? What we saw in the what we saw in Haiti after the earthquake was that people were so disengaged because of their lack of experience with democracy that it really made it very difficult for the government to do anything of substance.
Well, I think the Philippines is a quite different place than was Haiti after the earthquake. There is a broad base of democratic participation in the Philippines. Their big problem, I think, is geography. An island nation with over 700 populated islands, over 70 dialects, just communicating between Manila and the provinces, the other islands, is a challenge. Moving materials, as we've seen over the last week, into these islands which have been heavily affected, is a challenge. So the logistics of all of this is going to be something that's going to be difficult for the Philippines to overcome. But I think that they do have the benefit of having a broadly based democratic system.
What has inspired you in the last week as you look to the Philippine response, the U.S. response, and recalling your time in the Philippines?
Well, I think it's been a time of inspiration in terms of the international reaction to this tragedy, not just the United States, but other countries in Asia and indeed around the world. But the pictures on television, the images of Filipinos who are so badly affected by what has happened are really, for me, particularly heart-wrenching. It's been a difficult week for the Philippines, and it's going to be a difficult few years coming at them.
What is the sensitivity in U.S. involvement in the recovery effort? Certainly in the Marcos period and then after, there was a lot of concern that the U.S. would behave more like a colonial master than an ally in fostering democracy in the Philippines. How do you think that's in play now?
Well, it's a very different relationship now than it was back in the 1980s when I was there during those dramatic events. The relationship is still important. We still have a very strong tie to the Philippines, but it's very different than it was in the 80s at the height of the Cold War when we had two huge military bases there, when the experience with Ferdinand Marcos, who postured himself as a major U.S. asset, was still fresh in everyone's mind. I think the Philippines has come a long way in terms of establishing an independent base as a sovereign country. And I think that that's going to serve them well as they move forward. But they will need help. They need help desperately right now. And I think that the United States has demonstrated that we're prepared to step up and do what we can.
Do you think the politically sensitive decision of forgiving the debt burden after the revolution during your time as ambassador helped to lay the groundwork for the Philippine economy to be as resilient as it has demonstrated over the last few decades?
Well, we didn't really forgive it entirely, but we did make it easier for them to repay it. And I think that that has given us some credibility there. But this is an effort that the Philippines itself has to really take on. And I think they are capable of doing that. They have built a much stronger economy now than it was when we were there, although they have problems and they have a ways still to go. But the nature of our relationship there has changed. It's still very positive. It's still very important. But I don't think anyone any longer has any serious concerns that somehow we are in a neo-colonialist phase in the Philippines.
Do you have any memories of Tacloban during your time there that you're reminded of looking at the recovery effort this week?
I remember vividly going there in 1980s when we were celebrating the anniversary of the Leyte landings. And, of course, that's very near Tacloban. And my wife and I were there along with others from the diplomatic corps. And our hostess for the day was Imelda Marcos, who was, of course, from Leyte, from that region of the Philippines. And it was a day that someday I may write a story about.
Well, certainly poignant thoughts, yeah, and memories, thinking about a city that's very much changed by the events of this week. Ambassador Bosworth, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. It's good to be with you.
Ambassador Stephen Bosworth, former ambassador to the Philippines from 1984 to 1987, now a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center. We're collecting some of your memories of 50 years ago this month.
Sandy Abramson calling from Brooklyn. I was a senior in high school, and a friend and I left Philadelphia by bus to go to Worcester, Massachusetts, on the Connecticut Turnpike at the first toll booth. The bus driver got a message. He stopped the bus, told us the president had been shot. It was beyond shocking.
Share your recollections of the Kennedy assassination 50 years ago. We're broadcasting from KERA's studios in Dallas, Texas. You can reach us at 877-8MYTAKE or follow us at Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. Many economists and certainly a lot of jittery investors believe that the policies of the current Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke are the reason why the U.S. has crept out of the recession that hit global markets back in 2008. The easy money from the Fed, quantitative easing is the technical term, stimulus is the shorthand for the Fed buying its own debt bonds in the form of Treasury bills and buying packaged U.S. mortgages. It's the lifeblood of the recovery, such as it is.
I believe that supporting the recovery today is the surest path to returning to a more normal approach to monetary policy.
That's Janet Yellen, President Obama's nominee for chair of the Federal Reserve, testifying before Senate hearings on Thursday. Yellen is in a strange position at her confirmation hearing. She currently holds the number two post at the Fed, is keenly aware that her testimony to get her votes in the Senate could also produce real-time anxiety attacks in the markets while she's testifying. Heidi Moore, finance and economics editor for The Guardian, joins me now. Heidi, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
You know, this is a strange position. I mean, Janet Yellen does want to point out her differences with Ben Bernanke, but she's under some pressure to maybe pretend that she has no difference between Ben Bernanke and the policies of stimulus.
Yeah, the ironies are rampant. I mean, Bernanke himself barely got confirmed the last time around, and now all we want is more Bernanke. It's so ironic. But, you know, for Yellen, there actually are some key differences between her and Bernanke. Yes, she does want to continue the stimulus, but she has a notably more bearish or negative view on the economy than Bernanke does. He has always looked towards the sunny side, as has the White House and the Treasury Secretary. In fact, the White House sent out three graphs to its email list just this week saying these graphs prove that the recovery is strong. And Yellen has a slightly different message. She's saying there's a little bit of a recovery here, but things are not as good as we think and we have to keep taking action.
And since markets love to read the tea leaves on these kinds of statements that sound so, opaque from nominees for the Federal Reserve, officials for the Federal Reserve chairman, can we believe Janet Yellen in front of these hearings, or is she going to be so cautious that we really won't know the Yellen vision until she's actually confirmed, if she gets confirmed?
Well, I think she's cautious, but smartly cautious. I certainly don't think she'll be misleading. That wouldn't serve her, and it certainly wouldn't serve the Congress, who see this as a time to do some scoring against the president where they need to do that, especially in his performance on the economy. So we can trust what she says, but she's not reckless. I mean, it has always been the role of the Federal Reserve chairman to be as careful and as precise as possible in trying to describe the economy, except, of course, for Alan Greenspan, who preferred to say nothing like the Godfather.
Exactly. How much do you think Janet Yellen will address the circumstances which will probably define her term if she's confirmed? And that is the consequences for the Fed of this stimulus program that's gone on for so long.
That's really the big question. You know, as long as the Federal Reserve keeps buying these bonds out of the market, treasury bonds for the government and mortgage bonds, it is buying them and putting them on its own balance sheet. It's like, you know, taking on your child's debt and putting it on your own credit card. And that's what the Fed has been doing. And now its balance sheet has ballooned to trillions of dollars. And the question is, obviously, that's unsustainable in the same way that your credit limit would be unsustainable if you kept taking on everyone else's debt. But how does the Fed get out of it? And that's the big question facing Yellen right now. And she should be pressed on it because it's the most difficult economic question of our time.
Can those assets be unloaded, unwound in any sense, or will the Fed go bankrupt under Janet Yellen?
No, they can definitely be unwound, but it has to be very slowly and very, very carefully, or else there will be a panic.
Heidi Moore, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Heidi Moore is finance and economics editor for The Guardian U.S.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So, question, does smoking crack make you unfit to be mayor of a great city? Marion Barry raised that issue in the United States as mayor of Washington, D.C. back in 1990, but voters still sent him back to City Hall after a stint in federal prison. In Canada, though, this is more of a 21st century issue.
Yes, I have smoked crack cocaine. Do I? Am I an addict? No.
When have you?
Have I tried it? Probably in one of my drunken stupors, probably approximately about a year ago.
Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, whose self-destructive behaviors might make Anthony Weiner seem virtuous, in court documents released Wednesday detailing a pattern of drug abuse, erratic behavior.
I can assure you, I am not an alcoholic. I am not a drug addict. Have I drank? Have I done drugs? Yes, I have.
That's Rob Ford actually trying to reassure the Toronto City Council, his notion of damage control. You're hearing it right there. But his self-defense was less than entirely convincing.
The reason I drank or did drugs was not because of stress. It was out of sheer stupidity.
Sheer stupidity, perhaps an explanation for reportedly having staffers buy booze for him, or on St. Patrick's Day in 2012, getting into a fist fight with two staffers. Stephen Marsh, novelist and contributing editor for Esquire and a Toronto native, joins us now. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, John.
So how does this Ford scandal become emblematic of what's going on in Toronto? You've actually written about this, or is this just all about a guy named Rob Ford?
Well, I mean, the weird thing is that the whole Rob Ford scandal is kind of the antithesis of the city itself. I mean, Toronto is kind of, a liberal paradise, sort of post-industrial model city. I mean, you know, we've had less than 50 murders this year. For some similar American-sized cities, there are 50 murder weekends. Our bankers are still boring, and therefore our economy – we really had virtually no recession, really. And, you know, the city is incredibly law-abiding and incredibly lovely and sort of incredibly respectful and calm and quiet, except for the mayor, who's a crackhead. You know,
although isn't there some mythology here? I mean, Yonge Street in Toronto has a reputation as being a kind of, hippie mecca for, it's a little like Woodstock every weekend there on Yonge Street in Toronto. And there's also a well-established, pornography business online that's been centered in Toronto and to a certain extent in Montreal in Canada.
Montreal,
and that goes back a long time. Yeah.
Well, there's definitely a vice industry there. But that's different from crime, really, I would say. And so, you know, what we have with Rob Ford is really kind of a whole host of criminal activities and also hanging around with gangsters. I don't really know if there's a better term for that. That is really new. I mean, that really, I don't know where that comes from. I really don't. I don't think anybody does.
Are people of Toronto embarrassed by this, embarrassed for their city? Do they think this is a bit of a one-off, or do they kind of have a feeling, you know, Toronto should join the human race, maybe get a little bit of a dark underbelly?
I think the latter, it's sort of both. I mean, some people are embarrassed, but, you know, the truth is these are growing pains. We have 100,000 people move to the city every year. Chicago's shrinking and we're growing, and we're kind of replacing Chicago in that, you know, New York is New York and LA is LA, but we're kind of replacing Chicago. And along with that comes some nasty business, I think, almost inevitably. Also, you have to remember the mayor has no power. You know, the mayor can't actually make any decisions. So it's not like he's leaving this crack den and then going and making major decisions. That's just not true.
Replacing Chicago. We should talk to the people of Chicago about that, huh, Stephen?
Well, I mean, you know, it just in terms of the city of population, you know, they shrink. They lose about 37,000 people a year, and we gain about 100,000 a year.
And Rahm Emanuel actually has power as mayor of Chicago.
That's true, and he's a sensible person, you know.
Stephen Marsh, thanks so much. Novelist and contributing editor for Esquire, Toronto native, who's written about what's going on in Toronto with the Rob Ford mayoral scandal. Thanks, Stephen.
My pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from KERA Studios in Dallas, Texas today. I'm thinking about Toronto and Chicago there. Can a city be redeemed from its public scandals? Chicago certainly came back. Natasha down in South Florida says yes. She is thankful that the Miami Heat basketball team does afford her hometown some salvation. The scandals in this city, she writes, go way back from Elian Gonzalez to Memorial Weekend shootouts with police and zombie face-eating attacks by bath salt users. One scandal bigger than the next. At least we have the NBA champs, the Heat. Controversial, but unarguably a phenomenal team. That conversation going at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, how the city of Dallas has changed in the 50 years since its most tragic moment. But first,
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
So, Movie Friday, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer joins us. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. Both of them, of course, co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John. Hi, John.
So, let's begin with the Alexander Payne movie that's out this week, about Schmidt, Sideways, all about wine, The Descendants, his new movie, Nebraska, a father-son trip to rural Nebraska. Bruce Dern is in the cast. Here's a clip.
How did you and Mom end up getting married?
She wanted to.
You didn't?
I figured what the hell.
Were you ever sorry you married her?
All the time. Could have been worse.
Well, you must have been in love. At least at first.
Never came up.
Kind of a road movie, Thelma and Louise for old guys. Kristen, what'd you think?
Well, I wouldn't call it Thelma and Louise. It's a lot slower. There's a lot less action. This movie's in black and white, and there are lots of great, expansive cinematic shots of fields, of rundown barns, of parts of America that aren't quite the glorious places they once were. And in this movie, we have Bruce Dern, who's playing the father, who he's not quite with it anymore. He's older. He's chasing down a dream to win $1 million through something equivalent to the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes. His son, played by Will Forte, decides to accompany him on this trip. And along the way, they stop down in the town, the fictional town called Hawthorne, Nebraska, where Bruce Dern's character grew up, and meet a lot of old characters along the way and hopefully find out a little bit about each other and themselves. And I would say it's beautiful to look at. It's like a lot of Payne movies. It has some sly humor in it. But I found it at times just a little bit too misanthropic.
Well, sadness is what Alexander Payne is often all about in the midst of comedy. About Schmidt had great characters. Rafer, how does Payne do with the characters here?
I think he does really well, particularly, of course, with Bruce Dern, who turns in this fantastic performance. Bruce Dern's 77 years old, and, you know, he's a hot ticket again all of a sudden. You know, he won the Best Actor Award at Cannes. He was just at the Hampton Film Festival speaking. I think he's a total Oscar contender this year. BAM here in Brooklyn is having a retrospective of all his films, and I think he's all of a sudden he's back on top of his game at 77, and he totally deserves it. It's a great performance.
All right, next offering, Best Man Holiday. Let's listen to a clip.
Brian's my boyfriend.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh, this Brian. Okay, because I thought you meant the one... No, right, Brian. Brian McDougal.
McDonald.
McDonald, yeah. So it's good to finally meet you, Brian. She won't stop talking about you.
Sounds romantic, Kristen, but I can't make head nor tails of it. What's going on in Best Man Holiday?
Well, this is a sequel 14 years later to a movie called The Best Man. And in this movie, it follows the same group of people, a group of very well-to-do African-American college friends. Now they're in their early 40s. They have kids. They are dealing with literal life and death issues, as well as issues with their careers, with their lives, with their insecurities. And they get together over the holidays, and it's kind of like a dysfunctional family holiday movie where you get together around the table, you have fights, secrets come out, one of you is secretly sick, one of you secretly lost your job, and one of you is, you know, secretly dating somebody of a different race. And that clip we just heard is, oh gosh, you have a vanilla latte boyfriend. There are jokes along those lines. And so, you know, a lot of the movie's predictable. A lot of it's what you would expect. If you like these kinds of dysfunctional family holiday movies, you're probably going to love this movie. If you find them corny and schlocky, you're going to find this really, really corny and schlocky.
And you thought it was trivial, or you're on the fence there?
I thought the acting was terrific, but it just did not have enough of originality to it to really keep me interested.
Kristen, what's on the podcast this week?
So this week we're helping one of our Canadian listeners with our new feature called Movie Therapy with how to deal with the long, cold winter ahead. And we're going to prescribe some movies to her to help her deal with the cold times ahead.
Rafer, I'm interested in what your favorite movie reference to the Kennedy assassination is down over the last 50 years or so. Not that you're 50 or anything, but
no.
Exclude Oliver Stone. Okay, what's your favorite reference?
I think a good one would maybe be Parkland. That hasn't gotten a lot of traction. That's the one with Billy Bob Thornton, Zac Efron, Paul Giamatti. It's all told. It's the assassination as told from observers, secondary characters in the town of Dallas. And I thought it was really good. It was one of the few JFK movies I've seen that told me a few details I didn't know. And I liked that movie.
And we're going to talk a little more about it in just a moment. Kristen, for you, JFK reference that you love, assassination reference?
I know you're going to say I can't choose Oliver Stone, but I have to choose Oliver Stone because JFK is so good. Who doesn't love a good conspiracy theory? It's as American as apple pie, and it's so fun to watch. Every star you've ever loved is in that movie. And the complex puzzles they play out, the secrets, the lies, all of it, it's just such an enjoyable ride. I'm totally behind JFK.
It's coming back to theaters this month as well.
Yeah, I know. It's all lies. Kristen, you're so down market. Both of you guys, down market. Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks,
you too, John.
You too.
Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Fred, right down here in Dallas, has something to add to that. I attended a screening, he writes, of a documentary called Capturing Oswald this week in the Texas Theater. That screening and those guests actually changed the way I feel about the city of Dallas and how the local police force prepared for JFK's arrival and how they, without cell phones or even walkie-talkies, were able to capture Oswald in 88 minutes after the shooting. A fascinating story told from the viewpoint of the local Dallas police. We're also collecting your memories of the day that President Kennedy was shot.
This is Cleveland Adams of New York. 50 years ago, I was an 8-year-old growing up in a small, isolated town in Alabama, and I was shocked when the principal's voice came over the intercom and made the announcement that President Kennedy had been assassinated. But for me, the shock was immediately followed by an aftershock, when most of my classmates started clapping and cheering gleefully.
Keep the conversation going at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Coming up in a moment, Storytellers and the History of an American Tragedy. KERA Dallas producer and film critic Jerome Weeks joins us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at lumosity.com.
Historians and storytellers love to journey back in time.
November 1963, Kennedy's last days, the arrival in Texas. JFK, Jackie. Only one agent reacted to the gunfire. Do you see the rifle coming out of that window, or do you see Kennedy's head being blown apart?
I mean you. Yeah. Hey, pal, don't despair. You want to shoot a president? Come on and shoot a president.
A chilling monologue there from actor John Malkovich in the movie In the Line of Fire about a Secret Service agent who failed to save a president 50 years ago. And a tune from the dark and jaunty Stephen Sondheim musical Assassins about America's culture of single gunmen and women down through history. In recognition of the 50th anniversary of the assassination, KERA's culture producer and longtime film critic Jerome Weeks has been chronicling how the Kennedy assassination lives on in pop culture. Landmarks of downtown Dallas, historical icons, like Parkland, a movie out this year with a name that barely requires an explanation, even today.
Parkland Hospital is where Kennedy was rushed after he was shot in Dealey Plaza. And Peter Landsman, the writer-director of the film, concentrates on a number of characters, including Abraham Zapruder of the famous film, and the surgeons in the Parkland Hospital. So we see the Kennedy assassination. We don't actually see it directly. We see its effects on the people around it.
Right now, there are people out there that are ready to start a war. Now, the film in that camera is the only way we have to know what happened out here today. You understand that? It's a matter of national security.
I need to think.
Sir, I'm no longer asking.
Billy Bob Thornton there attempting to get the Zapruder film, right?
From Paul Giamatti playing exactly. Zapruder. Yes.
Now, is this a take us back in time kind of look at the Kennedy assassination, or is this fantasy more in the spirit of Oliver Stone, who we'll talk about in a moment?
No, it's quite the first. It is significant because it completely ignores conspiracy theories. And I think it's a very smart film in the way it concentrates on people like that they often don't know, like Lee Harvey Oswald's brother and his mother, for instance, and the Parkland surgeons, who, after they are stunned by having the president die there, then have to deal with Lee Harvey Oswald that same weekend. And so it's when it comes rushing back at them again, you can just see the weariness and the shock.
And of course, the opposite approach from Parkland is a movie like JFK, or I referred to a moment ago, Oliver Stone's movie, which is all about conspiracy, came out in the early 90s. Let's hear a very memorable clip. Here's actor Donald Sutherland.
Oswald, Ruby, Cuba, the mafia. Keeps them guessing like some kind of parlor game, prevents them from asking the most important question, why? Why was Kennedy killed? Who benefited? Who has the power to cover it up?
In many ways, the Kennedy conspiracy theories and Oliver Stone were a marriage, a Hollywood marriage made in heaven.
Or hell, if you sit through the director's cut. It's a long, talky film. In some ways, it's kind of a last gasp, I think, a throwback to that kind of mindset that it's all connected, that there is some ominous force drawing all these people together and causing this.
Less a piece of art and more maybe an argument with history itself. The musical Assassins by Stephen Sondheim is a much broader look at this whole notion of gun culture, assassins, and what you can do to make yourself a person of history. Here's a clip from Sondheim's Assassins.
Why do these rednecks always have three names? James Earl Ray, John Wilkes Booth, Lee Harvey Oswald.
And now the motorcade is turning onto Elm Street. There's someone holding up a banner, all the way with JFK.
What do you think the mission of Assassins is, and how does it much more broadly evoke the America affected by the Kennedy assassination?
Well, John, I spoke with John Weidman, who wrote that with Stephen Sondheim, and he said that the original intent was to write something on John Wilkes Booth or Lee Harvey Oswald. But the more they thought about it, the more they got the sense of this kind of overwhelming pattern in American history. Four presidential assassinations successful in a century, plus a half dozen other failures. And so he wanted to find out, what was it in America that leads people to do this? And the argument of Assassins is that, in effect, it's the failure of the American dream. A lot of the assassins, they don't have really articulated politics. Rather, they have a sense of resentment, a sense of something's failed, I'm owed attention.
You know, as I'm thinking about Art and the Kennedy assassination, there's so much of the media iconography from the funeral and from that day that has ended up on T-shirts. There's a very famous Oswald image of being shot by Jack Ruby, that John Jr. salute. All those are images kind of out of context and are pieces of American art on their own.
It's often said that Vietnam was the first TV war. Well, this was our first TV presidential funeral, our first live assassination. Jack Ruby shooting Oswald was live on American television. So those images were shocking even then. Also, the fact that the crucial frame in Zapruder's film was withheld for so long made that film even more a kind of lost treasure. And then when it was finally revealed, when people actually saw it in ABC News in the early 70s, it was a shocker, because people may have read conspiracy books like Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment, but that's only, you know, a couple hundred thousand. Millions saw the Zapruder film for the first time on ABC.
Speaking of books, Don DeLillo's Libra is an attempt to really cast all of this iconography. There's an amazing portrait of Marguerite, who is the mother of Lee Harvey Oswald, and their original upbringing and their very curious relationship.
I think it is one of the great pieces of art that has come out of this entire ferment over the assassination. It portrays Lee Harvey Oswald as this alienated, brutalized character. And I actually feel some degree of sympathy for him, partly because his mother is such a monster.
Finally, we're going to end with a clip from a movie, Winter Kills, which really reminds us that the Kennedy assassination is inseparable from the paranoia of the Cold War and all of the McCarthyist paranoia that preceded that Kennedy assassination. Here, listen.
What's your full name?
Arthur Jokers Fletcher.
We will hear your testimony.
I shot President Keegan.
Of course, President Keegan, imaginary character, but all of this very reminiscent of the Cold War, almost a Manchurian candidate kind of tone there. Where does this come from?
Well, Richard Condon wrote both Winter Kills and The Manchurian Candidate. And although the assassination sparked a great deal of the paranoid conspiracy thinking in America, people forget that The Manchurian Candidate came out before the president was assassinated. So there was, because of the Cold War, there was a fear. Generally, it was a right-wing fear of a communist infiltration. And that's really what's behind Manchurian Candidate. But with the JFK assassination and with other things that happened in the 60s, the government deceits over FBI investigations, over the Vietnam War, over civil rights, it became a more left-wing obsession. And so Winter Kills, in a way, sort of flip-flops Condon's earlier thinking in Manchurian Candidate.
Settling down, all of this artistic referencing of the Kennedy assassination, or just flaring up one last time for the 50th?
I spoke to an SMU literature professor recently about this, and he had a very interesting idea. He thinks it won't die until the baby boomers die off, because they still have that vivid memory.
They, meaning us, right, Jerome?
Exactly.
Jerome Weeks is Art and Seek producer and reporter at KERA in Dallas. Jerome, thanks so much.
Enjoyed it.
Your memories are adding to the conversation here at the Takeaway. Pat in Nyack, New York writes, I was 12 years old when President Kennedy was shot. I was out on the steps of my elementary school clapping erasers when a man came up the steps and said, go inside. The president has been shot. That moment continues to define my life until this day. Share your story at 877-8MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry in Dallas. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.